Hello and welcome to the Learning from Legends show with me, Peter Switzer. And this week I catch up with the economist who scared the pants off homeowners in 2008 in the GFC when he was talking about a possible 30% fall in house prices. He even took on a bet with another economist, Rory Robertson from Macquarie Bank in those days, on what would happen to house prices, which saw him have to walk from Canberra to Mount Kosciuszko with a T-shirt which said, "I was hopelessly wrong on house prices." But Steve has not always been on the wrong side of the economic debate. He was one of the few economists who warned about how debt could lead to something like the GFC. So let's get to know Professor Steve Keen and find out if he's a gloomster or a boomster right now. Well, I'm catching up with an old colleague of mine who was an economist and lecturer at the University of New South Wales, and then became an associate professor and professor of economics at University of Western Sydney and Kingston in London. And it's fair to say, even though he's a mate of mine, he has been arguably one of the most divisive economists in Australian history, but I'm sure he will know there were others and he'll name them. And I guess, you know, a lot of people got to know you during the GFC and some of the predictions that you made then. But Steve Keen, welcome to Learning from Legends.
Good to be here, mate, especially with somebody that I rubbed shoulders with, 30-something years ago, 34 years ago at Sydney, at New South Wales University?
Exactly right. In fact, yeah. I remember being in our PhD classes with you and noting that you were arguably the smartest guy in the room at that point in time. So I wasn't surprised that you became a very famous international economist. So Steve, I should point out for those people who don't know, Steve and I, while being mates, like most economists, disagree on a number of subjects. But I want to sort of trace the origins of you. So before you decided to do economics, you actually operated in the real world, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I did an arts law degree at Sydney University back in 71 to 75 and decided at the end of that I didn't want to become a lawyer, so I changed over to being a school teacher, which was actually a good profession back in those days, decently paid. I found that I found the headmaster wasn't a bad bloke, but the English master was a pain in the butt. And I was actually teaching remedial English, would you believe, and I was trained in economics. So I left that school and got a job in overseas aid, working for the Freedom Hunger Campaign. Then after that, I resigned from them to run conferences freelance on journalism. Ended up getting dragged back into the public service as part of the accord under the old Keating-Hawke Accord, and found myself fighting mainstream economists all the time inside the bureaucracy, and thought, well, I've got to get out of here and fight them on their own territory, which is the university sector. So that's why I decided to go back into my master's degree back in 87 when you and I met. And in the meantime, I'd ended up becoming a reviewer for two major Australian computing magazines, reviewing computer software, starting my own consulting business on computer software and database design. I've worn quite a few shirts before I became an academic.
Yeah, and one of them was also running marathons, weren't you?
I've always been a runner. I never did a competitive marathon. I used to run marathon distances in training, but I never did a competitive marathon. My best time in a half marathon was 90 minutes in the Sydney half marathon.
Yeah,
but also I did competitive Olympic weightlifting. At university, so, and I was considered turning professional at tennis as well when I started beating guys I knew in the top 100.
Yeah, so I'm glad I've never played you tennis, though we've always threatened to do so. All right, now let's go and talk, because when I was writing for The Australian, it was after my Sun Herald days, that was when you publish Debunking Economics. Give me the date of that, because I know it was pre-GFC, because I was writing about your predictions around there's a debt problem happening here and there are a lot of people asleep at the wheel. So just position that for us, Steve.
I started writing Debunking Economics in 1999. I finished it in 2001. And the motive of it was economic theory. Like there's a classic American humorist called Mencken who made the wonderful comment about to every human problem, there's a simple solution that is neat, plausible, and wrong. And that, to me, has always characterized mainstream economics. So my idea was to expose that before what I thought could be a crisis back in 2000, but I was hedging my bets. And then, of course, the crisis came along in 2005, and that's when I started sticking my neck well and truly above the parapet on the basis that you weren't going to be listened about the crisis after it if you didn't warn about it before it happened.
Hmm. Okay, so what was the reaction to your warnings? I know at the time I would say, well, look, things are growing nicely, but there are people out there like Steve Keen warning that there is a debt problem developing. Tell us, if you can, the precise warnings you're making before the GFC, which resulted in you winning an award called the Paul Revere Award, which is given out to, you know, those people who make negative claims, which actually turned out to be right. And I think you beat Nouriel Roubini, who became probably the most famous American predictor of the GFC. But what were you saying before the GFC that was being either ignored by the majority mm-hmm. or accepted by a minority?
Okay. Well, my PhD was actually modelling you would know this, Hyman Minsky's financial instability hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And so Minsky, whereas mainstream economics is all and the finance markets are all about efficiency and equilibrium, Minsky said it's all about debt and bubbles and financial instability, but he didn't produce a decent mathematical model of it. So I did that in my PhD thesis. And in 1992, I wrote the model. In 1995, it was published. But in 1992, what I found was that you had a tendency for effectively capitalists to borrow more money during a boom than they could repay during a slump. And so you got this ratcheting up effect in the level of debt. And then ultimately you got to a point where the level of debt was so great on the private sector side that it overwhelmed the economy and you had a crash in my model. But what actually happened beforehand in the model was quite remarkable. The cycles in the model diminished. There was falling cycles. And if you were a mainstream economist, you'd interpret that as something you might call the Great Moderation. Well, that is what I saw in my model in August of 1992. And in about 98, 99, 2000, people like Bernanke were coming out and saying, oh, isn't the Great Moderation wonderful? Diminishing cycles, it's all our great economic policy. And they were seeing it as, you know, their successful management of the economy using Federal Reserve interest rates to control everything. To me, it was a sign the underlying dynamics were headed towards a crisis.
So you're saying that if an economy is heading in the wrong direction, economic cycles are shortened as a consequence of it?
The amplitude drops.
Hmm. Okay. So you don't get the big fall, but you still do get a significant fall.
Well, what you get is ups and downs that are getting smaller. And if you believe the economy always heads towards equilibrium, you say, so it's going boom, 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 boom. Nice flat line coming our way. Everything's going to be wonderful. Mine stuff went boom, 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 flat line, and then suddenly it gets bigger and bigger. Mm. And it's actually a phenomenon known in fluid dynamics. It's called the Pomo-Manerville route to chaos. And my model, which I didn't even know about this chaos concept before I wrote it, that was what my model actually generated, the same basic dynamics, diminishing volatility on the way to a breakdown.
And what were the critics saying about your conclusions that you think were wrong?
Well, what they were saying is private debt doesn't matter. And so therefore, my model was driven by rising levels of private debt. And they were saying private debt is irrelevant to a capitalist economy. They treated private debt as like private sex, you know, consulting act between adults, which has no effect on macro society. And we shouldn't try to control individual acts of debt, just like we couldn't control individual acts of sex. And what I got instead was that this was systemic, that rising levels of private debt drove income towards bankers in a way, not from capitalists, but from workers. So you got rising inequality. And this was actually a whole part of the process of a breakdown ultimately. So they were saying what I was focusing on did not matter. And that's why, you know, when I saw the level of private debt going exponential compared to GDP back in 2005. That's why I started warning about an impending financial crisis, not just in Australia, but also the United States, which, of course, as soon as I saw the data in Australia, I checked out to see America. And America wasn't as bad, but it was still heading in the same direction.
But, Steve, people who have thought about the crash of the GFC will link it to collateral debt obligations and the famous ninja loans, which were in a sense covered up by the debt rating agencies, and then all of a sudden the master of the universe in the financial system, the people like Lehman Brothers said, we've made a big mistake, we better head for the exit doors, and the market crashed. What's wrong with that explanation?
Oh, that's the icing on the cake, okay? They're experts at icing. They can't make the dough. What I showed was the dough itself was causing the problem. So if it was just the case that it was, CDOs and stuff like that that caused the crisis, and then we learn about that so we don't make CDOs anymore, then that would be the end of the story. But what I found was the aggregate level of private debt. That's what I was measuring. Bugger whether it was, mortgage loans or credit cards or CDOs or anything exotic, just the aggregate amount of private debt divided by GDP. That was what I was focusing on, and that told me a crisis was coming. And then when the crisis occurred, it matched precisely what I was talking about, which was a huge fall in the rate of change of debt. So when you borrow money, you create money. A bank, when you borrow money from a bank, it creates money. You spend that money into the economy, that boosts aggregate demand. But if you pay your debt down, that actually subtracts from demand. And in America's case, change in debt went from plus 15% of GDP in 2007 to minus 5% of GDP in 2009. And that's what caused the crisis.
Yeah, okay. But then, Steve, my thinking on this subject is, the Americans called it a Great Recession. The biggest problem around their level of debt, even if you said to me, Australia as a percentage of GDP's debt was worse, but they had more inherent problems with their debt, didn't they, than we did, which partly explains why that their unemployment went over 10%, ours peaked at 6, why they had a great recession, we had a recession. No, we actually avoided the recession. So when you look at that, what's wrong with that? We had boom, we had excessive debt, we had a recession, and then America came out of it. What's wrong with that kind of economic and market cycle?
If it's a cycle, you're fluctuating around the same level, it wouldn't be a problem. It's the rising level of private debt that's the problem. Okay, if you go back to, and I'm looking at the data on my screen right now, if you go back to, in America's case, to 1945, the end of the Second World War, the total level of debt was about 40 to 50% of GDP. Yeah. You fast forward to where it is now, that's private debt, it hit 170% at the peak of the financial crisis, and it fell to 150%, and now it's back at 160%. So you've effectively got three times as much debt as you had back in the end of the Second World War, which we call the golden age of capitalism for good reason. So if you want to return to a golden age, in my opinion, you've got to reduce the level of private debt by at least two-thirds.
Okay, so given that, and let's go back to the time when you did become, arguably at least the most divisive economist around the GFC, when you were making very bold predictions about what might happen to house prices, and that's when normal Australians got to know you because you're on 60 Minutes.
Hang on a sec. I'm going to dive in there, mate, because I got asked that question on house prices by Kerry O'Brien in the 7:30 report when half the show was devoted to me and the next day he invited you, Kevin Rudd. Now, I think if you get on the 7:30 report and you get half the program, okay, people already know about you. So what I did was I alerted the property sector to the fact that I was a potential enemy, and therefore they went for me for the jugular.
No, I'm not saying that you either were right or wrong, but the thing is, because of that program, and then 60 Minutes, I'm sure, picked up on you as well, and all of a sudden you became the person out there saying, be careful, there's going to be a major shake-up of the housing sector, right?
And the first time I even thought about the housing sector was I did a question from Kerry O'Brien.
Yeah.
I was mainly focused on the macroeconomics.
Yeah.
And what I said was that, well, after Japan's bubble economy burst back in 1990, it had a 40% fall in house prices over the next 10 to 15 years. And I see no reason why Australia will avoid the same outcome. Now, of course, that was a red rag to the bulls of the property market, including you, but you're a good mate, so I'll let you get away with it. That's when they went for the jugular with me. And at the same time, of course, the next day, as I said in the interview, Kevin Rudd was interviewed. 1 week later, the stimulus package came out, and that included doubling and trebling the amount of money the government gave to first home buyers. So the government's response has been to restart the bubble whenever it started to fall over. And that's why Australia, in comparison to America, Australia's household debt in America peaked at 100% of GDP and fell, is now 80. Australia was the same level of private debt as household debt as America in the late 1990s and is now over 120% of GDP. So I got the cause right, but the direction wrong. And that was both a combination of Australian government policy and the Australian mentality diving back into house prices whenever there's a problem.
Yeah. So, but have we seen then that other governments have kind of learnt from the Australian experience, hang on, when it comes to the response to the coronavirus? Because they're all becoming big spenders to, you know, offset the problem of a government effectively creating a recession by locking down and closing down economies.
Yeah, look, that's good. I mean, that is a good thing. And yes, there is some learning from Australia's experience, because you remember back in the early days of this virus, it was the economy or health.
Yeah.
And Australia is one of the few countries, not courtesy of Morrison, I might add, but courtesy of our state premiers, who went health first, and we'll see what happens to the economy later. Well, the empirical evidence is overwhelming. The countries that took care of the health also took care of the economy. It wasn't a trade-off, it was a reinforcing process. And that, obviously America and Europe have done a devastatingly bad job initially, but now they're doing more spending. And America's relative better performance is actually largely due to its relatively larger level of government spending as well. So yes, there has been some learning courtesy of COVID.
Okay, so my issue that I want to sort of thrash out with you is this. You know, for at least, let's go back to the start of my Sky Business program, 2009, you and I have been talking about this, and I've never ever argued that your predictions were implausible, that there was good reason to believe you might be right, and that's why I always interviewed you, and because I don't just run one side of an argument, but because I am actually in the business of talking about where markets might go, that's why some people unfairly call me a perma bull or property bull or market bull, because at the end of the day, I want to be right. One day I will be a Steve Keen and predict it's all going to go to mush. But I'm seeing governments respond, Steve, in a way that actually is maybe papering over the cracks and keeping it all going. But looking back at your history, and given the fact I said to you that when I first met you, you were the smartest guy in the room, what has been your lesson? What have you learned about, you know, making bold predictions based on a lot of clever thought, but when you're confronted with what happens in the real world, what have been the lessons for you?
Well, don't trust the property sector to start with, because I never actually shook hands on that bet with Rory Robinson, okay?
Right.
I never even discussed terms. So I got shafted and I realised I had to fight back, which is why I did the walk to Kosciuszko, basically up yours type response on that front. So be careful about who you... For example, Ted Nordhaus's brother... nephew challenged me for a bet over climate change. And I declined because he was not taking the bet in good faith. Okay, I can provably he gave an answer to a question that I said, this is my I'll take part conditional on your response. His answer was so bad, if a student had submitted it, I would have sailed him and said, no, I'm not going to take you up on the bed. So I learned how to be careful about being picked out and shafted, because only in Australia am I criticised for getting house prices wrong. In the rest of the world, I'm seen for getting the financial crisis right. And it pisses me off, frankly. It does piss me off.
Yeah.
But the only thing I get asked by Australian commentators is house prices. And to add to it, if I look at my causal analysis, okay, what causes house prices, I say it's rising levels of new mortgage debt. Now, when I put that argument against the American data, I'll use a bit of a technical term, you know, the idea of a correlation coefficient. I get a correlation coefficient between American house prices and the rate of change of new mortgages of 0.64. And that's the place where the house prices crashed. I do exactly the same thing with Australian data. I get a correlation coefficient of 0.61, okay? Barely different. And that's where house prices has boomed. So I got the cause right. What I got wrong was this capacity of Australians to get sucked into taking on more mortgage debt.
I'm not here to ever say you were wrong or you were right. In fact, I think it's even a fascinating part of history that, you know, you so riled the lovers of property that people still scoff at you. But you also know that well-known economists also just thought you were wrong. All right, so in addressing, and they are well-known economists, and none of them necessarily are rude to you. They just
One of them is. Let's not forget Stephen Koukoulas.
Oh yes, right. Koukoulas, I think is his Greek pronunciation.
I'll stick with Koukoulas. That's close enough.
Okay, but I think the bottom line is, once you get yourself in the public forum, which is something you're not afraid to do, because I've seen you on BBC. BBC interviews, UK TV, and you don't back away from being controversial, because you're actually explaining why the considerations of the Greek government during Brexit weren't all that silly. Once you go into that domain, you're taking on mainstream economics. It would be really good for your reputation if things worked out the way you want them to work out. But often, I would have thought the big lesson for you is that you can be right, but government policy can actually, the word, trump you in many ways.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, for example, I mean, when the Rudd doubled and tripled the first home owner's grant, I called that Australia's subprime light, you know.
Yeah. You did.
And it's true that the scale of government, and that's one thing I've come to appreciate more in my mathematical modelling over time, the government has a limitless capacity to create money.
Yeah.
Now, in Australia's case, that limitless capacity has been directed at house prices. And it's also got a capacity to suck the household sector into borrowing more money, which is done very successfully. It's that Australia's household debt back in 1972 was 38% of GDP. It's now 122% of GDP. So yeah, we've been encouraged to borrow, and now interest rates now are the same as they were back in the 60s and 70s. So households are paying far more money to keep those house prices alive.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you. That's what they can work and keep the house prices up. But what it gives you is an economy which is, you know, characterized by houses on the one house side, rising house prices, and holes on the other, the mining, no manufacturing sector. And now when COVID comes along, we find we can't even manufacture a local mRNA virus because we don't have the technological capabilities anymore. So it might be, you know, you might be able to drive house prices up, but it's a stupid way to run a country.
Okay. And let's just go back to, like, to my way of thinking, a lot of your predictions were based on what you would see as being more logical policy or maybe more appropriate policy rather than logical policy. But neither you or me would have ever expected to see central banks behave the way they are now and driving interest rates down so low and then telling us they're not going to raise interest rates to 2023 or 24. This is another example of how policy can delay your day of reckoning. Is that a fair call?
Well, I actually bought government bonds back in 1995 or thereabouts because I expected interest rates to fall for the next two decades. And that was on the basis that with rising levels of private debt, the only thing you can do is reduce the interest rates. Because if you try to put rates up right now, when households are carrying 120% of GDP as their debt level, then within a very short while, you'd have lots of bankrupt households out there. Mm. So it's not that the government's controlling interest rates. The level of private debt's controlling everything, including the government. So you know, my whole objective was to expose how useless mainstream economics is, because you talk to a mainstream economist. In fact, I expect you to talk. Why don't you talk to one of my critics about this? Does private house private debt matter? Oh, nah, mate, doesn't matter at all. Bullshit. Sorry. The proper analysis, which I've done both logically and mathematically, private debt is an essential component of a capitalist economy. It drives the economy more than virtually anything else except government policy. And would the best policy be to reduce that level of private debt rather than encouraging people to take on more of it, which is what Australia has done.
Okay. Now, despite the fact you've got your critics, you also have a big fraternity of supporters out there as well. What are you telling them now about what you think is going to happen to the global economy, given what we're seeing now, Steve? We're seeing, and like, for example, what I'm saying, I know you occasionally read me, and one of the things came from Michael Knox, who I think is actually a very clever economist from Morgans in Brisbane. And remember Ron Bewley? Ron reckons that Morgan is one of the better econometricians in the country. Now, he said in May of last year, he said, if the vaccination program comes out faster than we expect, given, remember, they were talking about maybe mid-2021 or even later 2021, he said, given the amount of stimulus everyone's promising to spend, we could actually see a rerun of the Roaring Twenties. And look, we certainly are seeing a lot of growth happening, and I wouldn't be surprised to see strong growth over the next 2 years. And that could cover up a lot of the problems that you perceive. But what are you saying to the people who turn to you, and as I say, you've got a big following, about when the day of reckoning might come, given what you're seeing?
Well, the main thing I'm focusing on these days, as you know, is actually the reckoning from the climate rather than reckoning from the economy. So if we didn't have climate to worry about, then I'd see a massive growth coming out of the government stimulus. Like in America's case, the stimulus has been equivalent to 30% of GDP. So it's a huge level of stimulus. And the government has a... particularly in America's case, effectively a limitless capacity to do that. So it would be in a fairly strong boom. The thing which is holding it back is, again, the level of private debt. And I'm actually now modelling what I call a modern debt jubilee and showing that if you reduce the level of private debt, you actually stimulate the economy dramatically, because you end up transferring money from bankers who don't spend very much per capita to workers who spend a large amount per capita, and you boost the economy courtesy of reducing the level of private debt. Now, with things that won't be done, you'll get growth coming out of the government stimulus, but it will be less than people anticipate. And then the other factors, I mean, the inflationary side of things, I wouldn't be worrying about because I see overall deflation as the trend, except that we are now seeing we're reaching some of the physical limits of minerals production in particular,
now,
food production too, out of global wine.
I want to finish in that area because I know that's your current level of real interest. But let me bring in one of your favourite sparring partners, Chris Joy, and Chris would say looking back at, you know, some of the battles you two have had, that when you look at the level of household debt, which indisputably is very high as a percentage of GDP, it was the second highest behind Switzerland, but probably is over Switzerland now. But
now Switzerland's got a few gnomes there. Don't forget about the financial sector of Switzerland and the amount of money that's hidden there. Yeah. Also the amount of debt. So I think Australia's actually number one in terms of endogenous debt dynamics.
Well, as someone called Switzerland, I'm glad we're not the highest debt per GDP country in the world. But Steve, what Joy would say to you now, and I'd love to hear what you'd say to him if he was here, he would say, That debt problem was particularly serious when we had normal interest rates. But because we have ridiculously low interest rates, the serviceability of the debt for lots of those people with private debt is going to be a lot easier until central banks start saying, OK, the party's over, now you're going to have to start paying higher interest rates. I suspect he might say that. probably more aggressively than me. What would you say to that? The fact that serviceability...
Well, first of all, the moment they put up interest rates, the economy is going to tank, so they'll go in the opposite direction again. So they won't be able to put up interest rates for any sustained length of time. Even if they're ignoring the level of private debt, so they might well do it. When they put the rates up, it'll have 5-6 times the bang the interest rate rises that had back in the 60s, and we'll have another recession courtesy of rate rises. But the main thing is, you rely, if credit is part of aggregate demand, which it is, and that's part of my mathematical proofs of the nature of a monetary economy, credit's part of aggregate demand. If it's a large part of aggregate demand, and you want to keep the economy growing at the same rate, you've got to keep the rate of level of debt rising over time. Now, yes, okay, the serviceability is much more affordable when you get interest rates down at the, 1 and 2% level for mortgages. But if you can't afford to increase the level of debt, if you start flatlining at, say, 120, 130% of GDP, you won't get any credit demand coming out of the household sector, and therefore your rate of growth will slow down. Now, that's the problem. The only way that you can continue doing this is to continue increasing the level of private debt. Now, Australians have been brilliant at doing that so far, but they've got to keep on doing it till kingdom come for it not to become a problem.
Okay, so when people ask me, what is the likely scenario over the next 2 to 3 years, I say to them, well, I think there's going to be a big boom, and that boom will create growth. And we better hope that growth is good, because it's going to be the only way in which governments will be able to pay down their debt.
Debt doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay, I know it doesn't matter, but I still will try and pay it down. As you know, there is things called the crowding out effect and all those sorts
which is empirically shown to be bullshit by another good friend of ours, Com Kearney, 40 years ago. Yeah. When you do the statistics, there's not crowding out, there's crowding in, okay? Government spending boosts private investment. For often an obvious reason, if you build a harbour, people are going to build coffee shops along the shoreline. This is the same mistake as seeing a trade-off, but not as bad, but the same mistake as seeing a trade-off between health and the economy.
Okay.
It wasn't a trade-off, it's amplification.
Okay. So therefore, in a sense, you're making my growth story even more plausible. So there's no crowding effect. It's going to be all this spending, fantastic business investment as a consequence of it, lots of job creation, and all those sorts of things will once again take away the imminent arrival of a day of reckoning. True or false?
If we had a manufacturing sector, okay? The trouble is, at the same time we've been boosting house prices, the manufacturing sector's been falling over. You'll see a story in the papers today, the day we're recording this, where the vaccine manufacturers are moving offshore. Well, that's just what we need. And there's a wonderful database called the Atlas of Economic Complexity that looks just how sophisticated an economy is in terms of what it can produce. Mm. And Australia ranks below Senegal. Okay, so we don't have a manufacturing sector. So the jobs which will be generated will be in services. And the minerals and so on, if we're lucky with exports to the rest of the world. Mm. But it's not a viable economy. It is very much a dependent economy and ridden by a Ponzi scheme, which is the household sector.
Okay,
So therefore,
to sum up, before we finish off on what you're seeing around climate change and the threats and the opportunities, just in a nutshell, given where we are, because remember, people watch my program to try and work out, should they buy property? Should they buy stocks? Should they, whatever activity? Or is it time to sell or time to buy? What do you think is going to happen over the next 2 to 3 years in things like property prices, stock market, and the economy?
The stock market's boosted by quantitative easing.
Right. So low interest rates.
And low interest rates, mainly by QE, actually, but yes, by both. So, stock market's likely to continue rising, and whenever they start to fall, central banks will turn on the QE taps again and boost them up again. So there's certainly buy-the-dip opportunities courtesy of exploiting what central banks are doing wrong.
Right.
And in terms of property, a similar thing with Australia, but I still think you've got to be reaching saturation, okay? 120% debt-to-GDP ratio, how much higher can it go? 150, 160? The world record's actually held by Denmark at about 150% of GDP, 145%. That's with an enormous export surplus, which buffers what's happening on the private sector. If Australia has to get to those levels to be able to maintain that continuing rising in house prices. At the same time, of course, what Canada's done on COVID is benefiting Australia because wealthy Chinese are more likely to move to Australia than Canada now. So that'll keep boosting house prices. So, yeah, it's a nice, if you want to gamble, yeah, throw some money at the housing property market and the share market. If you want to build something, get outside the casino.
What? So one last one before we go to the climate is, when do you think the next recession shows up then?
I'm really not factoring one in, frankly. I mean, when I wrote the book, you can see it on the bottom of that, over that side, yeah. Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? I said the only countries likely to have one were countries that avoided one in 2008. That includes Australia and Canada, but they've both maintained housing bubbles to keep themselves somewhat afloat. But overall, I said you have a crisis, you've got to have a boom beforehand. And I couldn't see a huge boom coming out from the private sector. So I didn't see a huge slump coming along either. Similar thing for the current state. The main thing I'm worried about is when they start pulling all the government supports out of the way that keep people financial during COVID, there's been a dramatic increase in debt for the corporate sector, not for households, but the corporate sector. America's corporate debt levels risen by over 10% of GDP between January and September of last year. So that is going to mean a lot more financial fragility than people expect. So I do expect to see some disturbance in the corporate sector around the world because of that. But overall, I'm not seeing a recession. I'm certainly not seeing a global financial crisis.
Okay. Now, all right. So allow me to infuse my usual optimism away from property and stocks and economies to the outlook for climate and whatever. And I've always argued that climate change is really important. In fact, I wrote a book called The Carbon Crunch, and Kevin Rudd decided to back away from all his commitment to carbon. And the book didn't sell. But I always if we couldn't sell it, he changed the rules of the game. But the bottom line is that the world is now embracing it. You got a US president embracing it. There's a lot more commitment to the caring about climate change, and I always say that when mankind actually decides to do something, they can actually surprise us, getting vaccines ahead of schedule, beating the coronavirus in Australia at least better than most. Mankind can sometimes surprise not only me but even pessimists, Steve, and I'm not calling you a pessimist, but so. You're seeing change. I know you moved into the climate era because you were worried about the implications of it. But if the world changes over the next decade, could the results be a lot better than what the doomsday merchants have been predicting?
I think, not so much the results can be better from new policy, but the situation we're in is worse than people realise. And that's what scares me. Because we have been fooled by economists. And by the way, this is one reason I want to abolish neoclassical economics. Okay, I think it's become a threat to the existence of humanity and clearly a threat to capitalism itself, that theory. So my objective has always been to get rid of mainstream economics, and that's on steroids now, seeing what they've done on climate change and trivialising the dangers. So I think when we find that, when we actually start taking it really seriously, then we'll find we've got to go backwards. We're going to have controlled, if possible, decline in the level of living standards, level of to reduce our load on the planet and give us some chance to stop some of the disturbances we're already setting in train from destroying the habitability of the planet. So, yes, we can surprise ourselves, but we're going to have to treat this, put it this way, it's like the difference between Chamberlain and Churchill over Hitler. Okay, we're still in the Chamberlain mode. We've got to get into the Churchill mode about climate change.
Well, on that point, Steve, with you quoting Winston Churchill, I think it's a fantastically ironic way to end this interview. Now, one last question. Is there going to be a book on climate change from you eventually?
There's a new book coming out called The New Economics, The Manifesto, and that's on everything. That's on what I think economics should be. the approach we should take to it, and that includes a section on climate change, and it castigates William Nordhaus, Richard Toll, all the mainstream neoclassical economic suspects for trivialising climate change so badly that it's... If William Nordhaus was a student of mine, I wouldn't have given him the Nobel Prize. I would have failed him and kicked him out of the university.
Well, always controversial, Steve. Steve Keane, thanks for joining us.
Good to talk, mate.
And that's the show for this week. If you're interested in investing in stocks, have a look at my YouTube TV show. Just go to YouTube, Switzer Investing, and you'll get our latest show with a lot of great tips on the stock market. And make sure you become a subscriber. It really helps us to have more and more subscribers. Thanks for joining us on the Learning from Legend show with me, Peter Switzer. Talk to you next week.